Blackstone Audio presents My Antonia by Willa Cather. To Carrie and Irene Miner, in memory of affections old and true. Optima dies, prima fugit. Virgil. Introduction. Last summer, in a season of intense heat, Jim Burden and I happened to be crossing Iowa on the same train. He and I are old friends. We grew up together in the same Nebraska town, and we had a great deal to say to each other. While the train flashed through never-ending miles of ripe wheat, by country towns and bright-flowered pastures and oak groves wilting in the sun, we sat in the observation car, where the woodwork was hot to the touch and red dust lay deep over everything. The dust and heat, the burning wind, reminded us of many things. We were talking about what it is like to spend one's childhood in little towns like these, buried in wheat and corn, under stimulating extremes of climate, burning summers when the world lies green and billowy beneath a brilliant sky, when one is fairly stifled in vegetation, in the color and smell of strong weeds and heavy harvests, blustery winters with little snow when the whole country is stripped bare and gray as sheet iron. We agreed that no one who had not grown up in a little prairie town could know anything about it. It was a kind of Freemasonry, we said. Although Jim Burden and I both live in New York, I do not see much of him there. He is legal counsel for one of the great Western railways and is often away from his office for weeks together. That is one reason why we seldom meet. Another is that I do not like his wife. She is handsome, energetic, executive, but to me she seems unimpressionable and temperamentally incapable of enthusiasm. Her husband's quiet tastes irritate her, I think, and she finds it worthwhile to play the patroness to a group of young poets and painters of advanced ideas and mediocre ability. She has her own fortune and lives her own life. For some reason, she wishes to remain Mrs. James Burden. As for Jim, disappointments have not changed him. The romantic disposition which often made him seem very funny as a boy has been one of the strongest elements in his success. He loves with a personal passion the great country through which his railway runs and branches. His faith in it and his knowledge of it have played an important part in its development. During that burning day when we were crossing Iowa, our talk kept returning to a central figure, a Bohemian girl whom we had both known long ago. More than any other person we remembered, this girl seemed to mean to us the country, the conditions, the whole adventure of our childhood. I had lost sight of her altogether, but Jim had found her again after long years and had renewed a friendship that meant a great deal to him. His mind was full of her that day. He made me see her again, feel her presence, revived all my old affection for her. From time to time, I've been writing down what I remember about Antonia, he told me. On my long trips across the country, I amuse myself like that, in my stateroom. When I told him that I would like to read his account of her, he said I should certainly see it, if it were ever finished. Months afterward, Jim called at my apartment one stormy winter afternoon, carrying a legal portfolio. He brought it into the sitting room with him and said, as he stood warming his hands, "Here is the thing about Antonia. Do you still want to read it? I finished it last night. I didn't take time to arrange it. I simply wrote down pretty much all that her name recalls to me. I suppose it hasn't any form. Hasn't any title, either." He went into the next room, sat down at my desk, and wrote across the face of the portfolio, "Antonia." He frowned at this moment, then prefixed another word, making it, "My Antonia." That seemed to satisfy him. Book 1. The Shimerdas. Chapter 1. I first heard of Antonia on what seemed to me an interminable journey across the great Midland Plain of North America. I was 10 years old then. I had lost both my father and mother within a year, and my Virginia relatives were sending me out to my grandparents, who lived in Nebraska. I traveled in the care of a mountain boy, Jake Marpole, one of the hands on my father's old farm under the Blue Ridge, who was now going west to work for my grandfather. Jake's experience of the world was not much wider than mine. He had never been in a railway train until the morning when we set out together to try our fortunes in a new world. We went all the way in day coaches, becoming more sticky and grimy with each stage of the journey. Jake bought everything the newsboys offered him: candy, oranges, brass collar buttons, a watch charm, and for me, a Life of Jesse James, which I remember as one of the most satisfactory books I have ever read. Beyond Chicago, we were under the protection of a friendly passenger conductor who knew all about the country to which we were going and gave us a great deal of advice in exchange for our confidence. He seemed to us an experienced and worldly man who had been almost everywhere. In his conversation, he threw out lightly the names of distant states and cities. He wore the rings and pins and badges of different fraternal orders to which he belonged. Even his cuff buttons were engraved with hieroglyphics, and he was more inscribed than an Egyptian obelisk. Once, when he sat down to chat, he told us that in the immigrant car ahead there was a family from across the water whose destination was the same as ours. "They can't any of them speak English, except one little girl, and all she can say is, 'We go Black Hawk, Nebraska.' She's not much older than you, 12 or 13 maybe, and she's as bright as a new dollar. Don't you want to go ahead and see her, Jimmy? She's got the pretty brown eyes, too." This last remark made me bashful, and I shook my head and settled down to Jesse James. Jake nodded at me approvingly and said you were likely to get diseases from foreigners. I do not remember crossing the Missouri River or anything about the long day's journey through Nebraska. Probably by that time I had crossed so many rivers that I was dull to them. The only thing very noticeable about Nebraska was that it was still, all day long, Nebraska. I had been sleeping, curled up in a red plush seat, for a long while when we reached Black Hawk. Jake roused me and took me by the hand. We stumbled down from the train to a wooden siding where men were running about with lanterns. I couldn't see any town or even distant lights. We were surrounded by utter darkness. The engine was panting heavily after its long run. In the red glow from the firebox, a group of people stood huddled together on the platform, encumbered by bundles and boxes. I knew this must be the immigrant family the conductor had told us about. The woman wore a fringe shawl tied over her head, and she carried a little tin trunk in her arms, hugging it as if it were a baby. There was an old man, tall and stooped. Two half-grown boys and a girl stood holding oilcloth bundles, and a little girl clung to her mother's skirts. Presently a man with a lantern approached them and began to talk, shouting and exclaiming. I pricked up my ears, for it was positively the first time I had ever heard a foreign tongue. Another lantern came along. A bantering voice called out, "Hello! Are you Mr. Burden's folks? If you are, it's me you're looking for. I'm Otto Fuchs. I'm Mr. Burden's hired hand, and I'm to drive you out. Hello, Jimmy, ain't you scared to come so far west?" I looked up with interest at the new face in the lantern light. He might have stepped out of the pages of Jesse James. He wore a sombrero hat with a wide leather band and a bright buckle, and the ends of his mustache were twisted up stiffly like little horns. He looked lively and ferocious, I thought, as if he had a history. A long scar ran across one cheek and drew the corner of his mouth up in a sinister curl. The top of his left ear was gone, and his skin was brown as an Indian's. Surely this was the face of a desperado. As he walked about the platform in his high-heeled boots looking for our trunks, I saw that he was a rather slight man, quick and wiry, and light on his feet. He told us we had a long night drive ahead of us and had better be on the hike. He led us to a hitching bar where two farm wagons were tied, and I saw the foreign family crowding into one of them. The other was for us. Jake got on the front seat with Otto Fuchs, and I rode on the straw in the bottom of the wagon box, covered up with a buffalo hide. The immigrants rumbled off into the empty darkness, and we followed them. I tried to go to sleep, but the jolting made me bite my tongue, and I soon began to ache all over. When the straw settled down, I had a hard bed. Cautiously, I slipped from under the buffalo hide, got up on my knees, and peered over the side of the wagon. There seemed to be nothing to see. No fences, no creeks or trees, no hills or fields. If there was a road, I could not make it out in the faint starlight. There was nothing but land. Not a country at all, but the material out of which countries are made. No, there was nothing but land. Slightly undulating, I knew, because often our wheels ground against the brake as we went down into a hollow and lurched up again on the other side. I had the feeling that the world was left behind, that we had got over the edge of it and were outside man's jurisdiction. I had never before looked up at the sky when there was not a familiar mountain ridge against it, but this was the complete dome of heaven, all there was of it. I did not believe that my dead father and mother were watching me from up there. They would still be looking for me at the sheepfold down by the creek, or along the white road that led to the mountain pastures. I had left even their spirits behind me. The wagon jolted on, carrying me I knew not whither. I don't think I was homesick. If we never arrived anywhere, it did not matter. Between that earth and that sky I felt erased, blotted out. I did not say my prayers that night. Here I felt what would be, would be. Chapter 2. I do not remember our arrival at my grandfather's farm sometime before daybreak, after a drive of nearly 20 miles with heavy workhorses. When I awoke, it was afternoon. I was lying in a little room, scarcely larger than the bed that held me, and the window shade at my head was flapping softly in a warm wind. A tall woman, with wrinkled brown skin and black hair, stood looking down at me. I knew that she must be my grandmother. She had been crying, I could see, but when I opened my eyes she smiled, peered at me anxiously, and sat down on the foot of my bed.
"Had a good sleep, Jimmy?" she asked briskly.
Then in a very different tone she said, as if to herself, "My, how you do look like your father." I remembered that my father had been her little boy. She must often have come to wake him like this when he overslept.
"Here are your clean clothes," she went on,
stroking my coverlid with her brown hand as she talked.
"But first you come down to the kitchen with me and have a nice warm bath behind the stove. Bring your things. There's nobody about."
"Down to the kitchen" struck me as curious. It was always out in the kitchen at home. I picked up my shoes and stockings and followed her through the living room and down a flight of stairs into a basement. This basement was divided into a dining room at the right of the stairs and a kitchen at the left. Both rooms were plastered and whitewashed, the plaster laid directly upon the earth walls, as it used to be in dugouts. The floor was of hard cement. Up under the wooden ceiling there were little half-windows with white curtains and pots of geraniums and wandering Jew in the deep sills. As I entered the kitchen, I sniffed a pleasant smell of gingerbread baking. The stove was very large, with bright nickel trimmings, and behind it there was a long wooden bench against the wall and a tin washtub into which grandmother poured hot and cold water. When she brought the soap and towels, I told her that I was used to taking my bath without help.
"Can you do your ears, Jimmy? Are you sure? Well, now I call you a right smart little boy."
It was pleasant there in the kitchen. The sun shone into my bathwater through the west half-window, and a big Maltese cat came up and rubbed himself against the tub, watching me curiously. While I scrubbed, my grandmother busied herself in the dining room until I called anxiously,
"Grandmother, I'm afraid the cakes are burning."
Then she came laughing, waving her apron before her as if she were shooing chickens. She was a spare, tall woman, a little stooped, and she was apt to carry her head thrust forward in an attitude of attention, as if she were looking at something or listening to something far away. As I grew older, I came to believe that it was only because she was so often thinking of things that were far away. She was quick-footed and energetic in all her movements. Her voice was high and rather shrill, and she often spoke with an anxious inflection, for she was exceedingly desirous that everything should go with due order and decorum. Her laugh, too, was high, and perhaps a little strident, but there was a lively intelligence in it. She was then 55 years old, a strong woman, of unusual endurance. After I was dressed, I explored the long cellar next the kitchen. It was dug out under the wing of the house, was plastered and cemented with a stairway and an outside door by which the men came and went. Under one of the windows there was a place for them to wash when they came in from work. While my grandmother was busy about supper, I settled myself on the wooden bench behind the stove and got acquainted with the cat. He caught not only rats and mice, but gophers, I was told. The patch of yellow sunlight on the floor traveled back toward the stairway, and Grandmother and I talked about my journey and about the arrival of the new Bohemian family. She said they were to be our nearest neighbors. We did not talk about the farm in Virginia, which had been her home for so many years. But after the men came in from the fields and we were all seated at the supper table, then she asked Jake about the old place and about our friends and neighbors there. My grandfather said little. When he first came in, he kissed me and spoke kindly to me, but he was not demonstrative. I felt at once his deliberateness and personal dignity, and was a little in awe of him. The thing one immediately noticed about him was his beautiful, crinkly, snow-white beard. I once heard a missionary say it was like the beard of an Arabian sheik. His bald crown only made it more impressive. Grandfather's eyes were not at all like those of an old man. They were bright blue and had a fresh, frosty sparkle. His teeth were white and regular, so sound that he had never been to a dentist in his life. He had a delicate skin, easily roughened by sun and wind. When he was a young man, his hair and beard were red. His eyebrows were still coppery. As we sat at the table, Otto Fuchs and I kept stealing covert glances at each other. Grandmother had told me while she was getting supper that he was an Austrian who came to this country a young boy and had led an adventurous life in the far west among mining camps and cow outfits. His iron constitution was somewhat broken by mountain pneumonia, and he had drifted back to live in a milder country for a while. He had relatives in Bismarck, a German settlement to the north of us, but for a year now he had been working for Grandfather. The minute supper was over, Otto took me into the kitchen to whisper to me about a pony down in the barn that had been bought for me at a sale. He had been riding him to find out whether he had any bad tricks, but he was a perfect gentleman, and his name was Dude. Fuchs told me everything I wanted to know, how he had lost his ear in a Wyoming blizzard when he was a stage driver, and how to throw a lasso. He promised to rope a steer for me before sundown next day. He got out his chaps and silver spurs to show them to Jake and me, and his best cowboy boots, with tops stitched in bold design, roses and true lover's knots and undraped female figures. These, he solemnly explained, were angels. Before we went to bed, Jake and Otto were called up to the living room for prayers. Grandfather put on silver-rimmed spectacles and read several psalms. His voice was so sympathetic, and he read so interestingly, that I wished he had chosen one of my favorite chapters in the Book of Kings. I was awed by his intonation of the word Selah. He shall choose our inheritance for us, the excellency of Jacob whom he loved. Selah. I had no idea what the word meant. Perhaps he had not. But as he uttered it, it became oracular, the most sacred of words. Early the next morning, I ran out of doors to look about me. I had been told that ours was the only wooden house west of Black Hawk, until you came to the Norwegian settlement, where there were several. Our neighbors lived in sod houses and dugouts, comfortable but not very roomy. Our white frame house, with a story and a half story above the basement, stood at the east end of what I might call the farmyard, with the windmill close by the kitchen door. From the windmill, the ground sloped westward, down to the barns and granaries and pig yards. This slope was trampled hard and bare, and washed out in winding gullies by the rain. Beyond the corn cribs, at the bottom of the shallow draw, was a muddy little pond with rusty willow bushes growing about it. The road from the post office came directly by our door, crossed the farmyard, and curved round this little pond, beyond which it began to climb the gentle swell of unbroken prairie to the west. There, along the western skyline, it skirted a great cornfield, much larger than any field I had ever seen. This cornfield, and the sorghum patch behind the barn, were the only broken land in sight. Everywhere, as far as the eye could reach, there was nothing but rough, shaggy, red grass, most of it as tall as I. North of the house, inside the plowed firebreaks, grew a thick-set strip of box elder trees, low and bushy, their leaves already turning yellow. This hedge was nearly a quarter of a mile long, but I had to look very hard to see it at all. The little trees were insignificant against the grass. It seemed as if the grass were about to run over them and over the plum patch behind the sod chicken house. As I looked about me, I felt that the grass was the country, as the water is the sea. The red of the grass made all the great prairie the color of wine stains, or of certain seaweeds when they are first washed up. And there was so much motion in it, the whole country seemed, somehow, to be running. I had almost forgotten that I had a grandmother when she came out, her sunbonnet on her head, a grain sack in her hand, and asked me if I did not want to go to the garden with her to dig potatoes for dinner. The garden, curiously enough, was a quarter of a mile from the house, and the way to it led up a shallow draw past the cattle corral. Grandmother called my attention to a stout hickory cane tipped with copper, which hung by a leather thong from her belt. This, she said, was her rattlesnake cane. I must never go to the garden without a heavy stick or a corn knife. She had killed a good many rattlers on her way back and forth. A little girl who lived on the Black Hawk Road was bitten on the ankle and had been sick all summer. I can remember exactly how the country looked to me as I walked beside my grandmother along the faint wagon tracks on that early September morning. Perhaps the glide of long railway travel was still with me, for more than anything else I felt motion in the landscape, in the fresh, easy-blowing morning wind, and in the earth itself, as if the shaggy grass were a sort of loose hide, and underneath it herds of wild buffalo were galloping, galloping. Alone, I should never have found the garden, except, perhaps, for the big yellow pumpkins that lay about unprotected by their withering vines, and I felt very little interest in it when I got there. I wanted to walk straight on through the red grass and over the edge of the world, which could not be very far away. The light air about me told me that the world ended here. Only the ground and sun and sky were left, and if one went a little farther there would be only sun and sky, and one would float off into them like the tawny hawks which sailed over our heads making slow shadows on the grass. While Grandmother took the pitchfork we found standing in one of the rows and dug potatoes, while I picked them up out of the soft brown earth and put them into the bag, I kept looking up at the hawks that were doing what I might so easily do. When Grandmother was ready to go, I said I would like to stay up there in the garden a while. She peered down at me from under her sunbonnet. "Aren't you afraid of snakes?" "A little," I admitted, "but I'd like to stay anyhow." "Well, if you see one, don't have anything to do with him. The big yellow and brown ones won't hurt you. They're bull snakes and help to keep the gophers down. Don't be scared if you see anything look out of that hole in the bank over there. That's a badger hole. He's about as big as a big possum, and his face is striped black and white. He takes a chicken once in a while, but I won't let the men harm him. In a new country, a body feels friendly to the animals. I like to have him come out and watch me when I'm at work." Grandmother swung the bag of potatoes over her shoulder and went down the path, leaning forward a little. The road followed the windings of the draw. When she came to the first bend, she waved at me and disappeared. I was left alone with this new feeling of lightness and content. I sat down in the middle of the garden, where snakes could scarcely approach unseen, and leaned my back against a warm yellow pumpkin. There were some ground cherry bushes growing along the furrows, full of fruit. I turned back the papery triangular sheaths that protected the berries and ate a few. All about me, giant grasshoppers, twice as big as any I had ever seen, were doing acrobatic feats among the dried vines. The gophers scurried up and down the plowed ground. There in the sheltered draw bottom the wind did not blow very hard, but I could hear it singing its humming tune up on the level, and I could see the tall grasses wave. The earth was warm under me, and warm as I crumbled it through my fingers. Queer little red bugs came out and moved in slow squadrons around me. Their backs were polished vermilion with black spots. I kept as still as I could. Nothing happened. I did not expect anything to happen. I was something that lay under the sun and felt it, like the pumpkins, and I did not want to be anything more. I was entirely happy. Perhaps we feel like that when we die and become a part of something entire, whether it is sun and air or goodness and knowledge. At any rate, that is happiness, to be dissolved into something complete and great. When it comes to one, it comes as naturally as sleep. Chapter 3. On Sunday morning, Otto Fuchs was to drive us over to make the acquaintance of our new Bohemian neighbors. We were taking them some provisions, as they had come to live on a wild place where there was no garden or chicken house, and very little broken land. Fuchs brought up a sack of potatoes and a piece of cured pork from the cellar, and Grandmother packed some loaves of Saturday's bread, a jar of butter, and several pumpkin pies in the straw of the wagon box. We clambered up to the front seat and jolted off past the little pond and along the road that climbed to the big cornfield. I could hardly wait to see what lay beyond that cornfield, but there was only red grass like ours, and nothing else, though from the high wagon seat one could look off a long way. The road ran about like a wild thing, avoiding the deep draws, crossing them where they were wide and shallow, and all along it, wherever it looped or ran, the sunflowers grew. Some of them were as big as little trees, with great rough leaves and many branches which bore dozens of blossoms. They made a gold ribbon across the prairie. Occasionally one of the horses would tear off with his teeth a plant full of blossoms and walk along munching it, the flowers nodding in time to his bites as he ate down toward them. The Bohemian family, Grandmother told me as we drove along, had bought the homestead of a fellow countryman, Peter Kryak, and had paid him more than it was worth. Their agreement with him was made before they left the old country through a cousin of his who was also a relative of Mrs. Shimerda. The Shimerdas were the first Bohemian family to come to this part of the county. Kryak was their only interpreter and could tell them anything he chose. They could not speak enough English to ask for advice or even to make their most pressing wants known. One son, Fuchs said, was well grown and strong enough to work the land, but the father was old and frail and knew nothing about farming. He was a weaver by trade, had been a skilled workman on tapestries and upholstery materials. He had brought his fiddle with him, which wouldn't be of much use here, though he used to pick up money by it at home. "If they're nice people, I hate to think of them spending the winter in that cave of Kryak's," said Grandmother. "It's no better than a badger hole, no proper dugout at all. And I hear he's made them pay $20 for his old cook stove that ain't worth 10.
"Yes'm," said Otto. "And he sold him his oxen and his two bony old horses for the price of good work teams. I'd have interfered about the horses. The old man can understand some German, if I'd have thought it would do any good. But Bohemians has a natural distrust of Austrians."
Grandmother looked interested.
"Now, why is that, Otto?"
Fuchs wrinkled his brow and nose.
"Well, ma'am, it's politics. It would take me a long while to explain."
The land was growing rougher. I was told that we were approaching Squaw Creek, which cut up the west half of the Shimerda's place and made the land of little value for farming. Soon we could see the broken, grassy clay cliffs, which indicated the windings of the stream and the glittering tops of the cottonwoods and ash trees that grew down in the ravine. Some of the cottonwoods had already turned, and the yellow leaves and shining white bark made them look like gold and silver trees in fairy tales. As we approached the Shimerda's dwelling, I could still see nothing but rough red hillocks and draws with shelving banks and long roots hanging out where the earth had crumbled away. Presently, against one of those banks, I saw a sort of shed, thatched with the same wine-colored grass that grew everywhere. Near it tilted a shattered windmill frame that had no wheel. We drove up to this skeleton to tie our horses, and then I saw a door and window sunk deep in the drawbank. The door stood open, and a woman and a girl of 14 ran out and looked up at us hopefully. A little girl trailed along behind them. The woman had on her head the same embroidered shawl with silk fringes that she wore when she had alighted from the train at Blackhawk. She was not old, but she was certainly not young. Her face was alert and lively, with a sharp chin and shrewd little eyes. She shook Grandmother's hand energetically.
"Very glad, very glad," she ejaculated.
Immediately she pointed to the bank out of which she had emerged and said,
"House no good, house no good."
Grandmother nodded consolingly.
"You'll get fixed up comfortable after a while, Mrs. Shimerda. Make good house."
My grandmother always spoke in a very loud tone to foreigners, as if they were deaf. She made Mrs. Shimerda understand the friendly intention of our visit, and the Bohemian woman handled the loaves of bread and even smelled them and examined the pies with lively curiosity, exclaiming,
"Much good! Much thank!"
And again she wrung Grandmother's hand. The oldest son, Ambrosch, they called it Ambrosch, came out of the cave and stood beside his mother. He was 19 years old, short and broad-backed, with a close-cropped flat head and a wide, flat face. His hazel eyes were little and shrewd, like his mother's, but more sly and suspicious. They fairly snapped at the food. The family had been living on corn cakes and sorghum molasses for 3 days. The little girl was pretty, but Antonia, they accented the name thus strongly when they spoke to her, was still prettier. I remembered what the conductor had said about her eyes. They were big and warm and full of light, like the sun shining on brown pools in the wood. Her skin was brown, too, and in her cheeks she had a glow of rich, dark color. Her brown hair was curly and wild-looking. The little sister, whom they called Julka, was fair and seemed mild and obedient. While I stood awkwardly confronting the two girls, Kryak came up from the barn to see what was going on. With him was another Shimerda son. Even from a distance one could see that there was something strange about this boy. As he approached us, he began to make uncouth noises and held up his hands to show us his fingers, which were webbed to the first knuckle, like a duck's foot. When he saw me draw back, he began to crow delightedly, "Hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo!" like a rooster. His mother scowled and said sternly, "Medic!" then spoke rapidly to Kryak in Bohemian. "She wants me to tell you he won't hurt nobody, Mrs. Burden. He was born like that. The others are smart. Ambrosch, he make good farmer." He struck Ambrosch on the back, and the boy smiled knowingly. At that moment the father came out of the hole in the bank. He wore no hat, and his thick, iron-gray hair was brushed straight back from his forehead. It was so long that it bushed out behind his ears and made him look like the old portraits I remembered in Virginia. He was tall and slender, and his thin shoulders stooped. He looked at us understandingly, then took grandmother's hand and bent over it. I noticed how white and well-shaped his own hands were. They looked calm, somehow, and skilled. His eyes were melancholy and were set back deep under his brow. His face was ruggedly formed, but it looked like ashes, like something from which all the warmth and light had died out. Everything about this old man was in keeping with his dignified manner. He was neatly dressed. Under his coat he wore a knitted gray vest and, instead of a collar, a silk scarf of a dark bronze green, carefully crossed and held together by a red coral pin. While Kryak was translating for Mr. Shimerda, Antonia came up to me and held out her hand coaxingly. In a moment we were running up the steep drawside together, Julka trotting after us. When we reached the level and could see the gold treetops, I pointed toward them, and Antonia laughed and squeezed my hand as if to tell me how glad she was I had come. We raced off toward Squaw Creek and did not stop until the ground itself stopped, fell away before us so abruptly that the next step would have been out into the treetops. We stood panting on the edge of the ravine, looking down at the trees and bushes that grew below us. The wind was so strong that I had to hold my hat on, and the girls' skirts were blown out before them. Antonia seemed to like it. She held her little sister by the hand and chattered away in that language which seemed to me spoken so much more rapidly than mine. She looked at me, her eyes fairly blazing with things she could not say. "Name? What name?" she asked, touching me on the shoulder. I told her my name, and she repeated it after me and made Julka say it. She pointed into the gold cottonwood tree behind whose top we stood and said again, "What name?" We sat down and made a nest in the long red grass. Julka curled up like a baby rabbit and played with the grasshopper. Antonia pointed up to the sky and questioned me with her glance. I gave her the word, but she was not satisfied and pointed to my eyes. I told her, and she repeated the word, making it sound like ice. She pointed up to the sky, then to my eyes, then back to the sky, with movements so quick and impulsive that she distracted me, and I had no idea what she wanted. She got up on her knees and wrung her hands. She pointed to her own eyes and shook her head, then to mine and to the sky, nodding violently. "Oh!" I exclaimed. "Blue! Blue sky!" She clapped her hands and murmured, "Blue sky! Blue ice!" as if it amused her. While we snuggled down there out of the wind, she learned a score of words. She was quick and very eager. We were so deep in the grass that we could see nothing but the blue sky over us and the gold tree in front of us. It was wonderfully pleasant. After Antonia had said the new words over and over, she wanted to give me a little chased silver ring she wore on her middle finger. When she coaxed and insisted, I repulsed her quite sternly. I didn't want her ring, and I felt there was something reckless and extravagant about her wishing to give it away to a boy she had never seen before. No wonder Kryak got the better of these people if this was how they behaved. While we were disputing about the ring, I heard a mournful voice calling, "Antonia! Antonia!" She sprang up like a hare. "Tatinik! Tatinik!" she shouted, and we ran to meet the old man who was coming toward us. Antonia reached him first, took his hand and kissed it. When I came up, he touched my shoulder and looked searchingly down into my face for several seconds. I became somewhat embarrassed, for I was used to being taken for granted by my elders. We went with Mr. Shimerda back to the dugout where Grandmother was waiting for me. Before I got into the wagon, he took a book out of his pocket, opened it, and showed me a page with two alphabets, one English and the other Bohemian. He placed this book in my grandmother's hands, looked at her entreatingly, and said, with an earnestness which I shall never forget,
"Teach, teach my Antonia."
Chapter 4. On the afternoon of that same Sunday, I took my first long ride on my pony, under Otto's direction. After that, Dude and I went twice a week to the post office, 6 miles east of us, and I saved the men a good deal of time by riding on errands to our neighbors. When we had to borrow anything, or to send about word that there would be preaching at the sod schoolhouse, I was always the messenger. Formerly, Fuchs attended to such things after working hours. All the years that have passed have not dimmed my memory of that first glorious autumn. The new country lay open before me. There were no fences in those days, and I could choose my own way over the grass uplands, trusting the pony to get me home again. Sometimes I followed the sunflower-bordered roads. Fuchs told me that the sunflowers were introduced into that country by the Mormons, that at the time of the persecution, when they left Missouri and struck out into the wilderness to find a place where they could worship God in their own way, the members of the first exploring party, crossing the plains to Utah, scattered sunflower seed as they went. The next summer, when the long trains of wagons came through with all the women and children, they had the sunflower trail to follow. I believe that botanists do not confirm Fuchs's story, but insist that the sunflower was native to those plains. Nevertheless, that legend has stuck in my mind, and sunflower-bordered roads always seem to me the roads to freedom. I used to love to drift along the pale yellow cornfields, looking for the damp spots one sometimes found at their edges, where the smartweed soon turned a rich copper color and the narrow brown leaves hung curled like cocoons about the swollen joints of the stem. Sometimes I went south to visit our German neighbors and to admire their catalpa grove, or to see the big elm tree that grew up out of a deep crack in the earth and had a hawk's nest in its branches. Trees were so rare in that country, and they had to make such a hard fight to grow, that we used to feel anxious about them, and visit them as if they were persons. It must have been the scarcity of detail in that tawny landscape that made detail so precious. Sometimes I rode north to the big prairie dog town to watch the brown earth owls fly home in the late afternoon and go down to their nests underground with the dogs. Antonia Shimerda liked to go with me, and we used to wonder a great deal about these birds of subterranean habit. We had to be on our guard there, for rattlesnakes were always lurking about. They came to pick up an easy living among the dogs and owls, which were quite defenseless against them, took possession of their comfortable houses, and ate the eggs and puppies. We felt sorry for the owls. It was always mournful to see them come flying home at sunset and disappear under the earth. But, after all, we felt, winged things who would live like that must be rather degraded creatures. The dog town was a long way from any pond or creek. Otto Fuchs said he had seen populous dog towns in the desert where there was no surface water for 50 miles. He insisted that some of the holes must go down to water, nearly 200 feet, hereabouts. Antonia said she didn't believe it, that the dogs probably lapped up the dew in the early morning like the rabbits. Antonia had opinions about everything, and she was soon able to make them known. Almost every day she came running across the prairie to have her reading lesson with me. Mrs. Shimerda grumbled, but realized it was important that one member of the family should learn English. When the lesson was over, we used to go up to the watermelon patch behind the garden. I split the melons with an old corn knife, and we lifted out the hearts and ate them with the juice trickling through our fingers. The white Christmas melons we did not touch, but we watched them with curiosity. They were to be picked late, when the hard frosts had set in, and put away for winter use. After weeks on the ocean, the Shimerdas were famished for fruit. The two girls would wander for miles along the edge of the cornfields, hunting for ground cherries. Antonia loved to help Grandmother in the kitchen and to learn about cooking and housekeeping. She would stand beside her, watching her every movement. We were willing to believe that Mrs. Shimerda was a good housewife in her own country, but she managed poorly under new conditions. The conditions were bad enough, certainly. I remember how horrified we were at the sour, ashy gray bread she gave her family to eat. She mixed her dough, we discovered, in an old tin peck measure that Kryak had used about the barn. When she took the paste out to bake it, she left smears of dough sticking to the sides of the measure, put the measure on the shelf behind the stove, and let this residue ferment. The next time she made bread, she scraped this sour stuff down into the fresh dough to serve as yeast. During those first months, the Shimerdas never went to town. Kryak encouraged them in the belief that in Black Hawk they would somehow be mysteriously separated from their money. They hated Kryak, but they clung to him because he was the only human being with whom they could talk or from whom they could get information. He slept with the old man and the two boys in the dugout barn, along with the oxen. They kept him in their hole and fed him for the same reason that the prairie dogs and the brown owls house the rattlesnakes, because they did not know how to get rid of him. Chapter 5. We knew that things were hard for our Bohemian neighbors, but the two girls were light-hearted and never complained. They were always ready to forget their troubles at home and to run away with me over the prairie, scaring rabbits or starting up flocks of quail. I remember Antonia's excitement when she came into our kitchen one afternoon and announced, "My papa find friends up north with Russian mans. Last night he take me for sea, and I can understand very much talk. Nice mans, Mrs. Burden. One is fat and all the time laugh. Everybody laugh. The first time I see my papa laugh in this country. Oh, very nice." I asked her if she meant the two Russians who lived up by the big dog town. I had often been tempted to go see them when I was riding in that direction, but one of them was a wild-looking fellow and I was a little afraid of him. Russia seemed to me more remote than any other country, farther away than China, almost as far as the North Pole. Of all the strange, uprooted people among the first settlers, those two men were the strangest and the most aloof. Their last names were unpronounceable, so they were called Pavel and Peter. They went about making signs to people, and until the Shimerdas came, they had no friends. Kryak could understand them a little, but he had cheated them in a trade, so they avoided him. Pavel, the tall one, was said to be an anarchist, since he had no means of imparting his opinions. Probably his wild gesticulations and his generally excited and rebellious manner gave rise to this supposition. He must once have been a very strong man, but now his great frame, with big, knotty joints, had a wasted look, and the skin was drawn tight over his high cheekbones. His breathing was hoarse, and he always had a cough. Peter, his companion, was a very different sort of fellow. Short, bow-legged, and as fat as butter. He always seemed pleased when he met people on the road, smiled and took off his cap to everyone, men as well as women. At a distance, on his wagon, he looked like an old man. His hair and beard were of such a pale flaxen color that they seemed white in the sun. They were as thick and curly as carded wool. His rosy face, with its snub nose set in this fleece, was like a melon among its leaves. He was usually called Curly Peter, or Russian Peter. The two Russians made good farmhands, and in summer they worked out together. I had heard our neighbors laughing when they told how Peter always had to go home at night to milk his cow. Other bachelor homesteaders used canned milk to save trouble. Sometimes Peter came to church at the sod schoolhouse. It was there I first saw him, sitting on a low bench by the door, his plush cap in his hands, his bare feet tucked apologetically under the seat. After Mr. Shimerda discovered the Russians, he went to see them almost every evening, and sometimes took Antonia with him. She said they came from a part of Russia where the language was not very different from Bohemian, and if I wanted to go to their place, she could talk to them for me. One afternoon, before the heavy frost began, we rode up there together on my pony. The Russians had a neat log house built on a grassy slope, with a windlass well beside the door. As we rode up the draw, we skirted a big melon patch and a garden where squashes and yellow cucumbers lay about on the sod. We found Peter out behind his kitchen, bending over a washtub. He was working so hard that he did not hear us coming. His whole body moved up and down as he rubbed, and he was a funny sight from the rear with his shaggy head and bandy legs. When he straightened himself up to greet us, drops of perspiration were rolling from his thick nose down onto his curly beard. Peter dried his hands and seemed glad to leave his washing. He took us down to see his chickens and his cow that was grazing on the hillside. He told Antonia that in his country only rich people had cows, but here any man could have one who would take care of her. The milk was good for Pavel, who was often sick, and he could make butter by beating sour cream with a wooden spoon. Peter was very fond of his cow. He patted her flanks and talked to her in Russian while he pulled up her lariat pin and set it in a new place. After he had shown us his garden, Peter trundled a load of watermelons up the hill in his wheelbarrow. Pavel was not at home. He was off somewhere helping to dig a well. The house, I thought, very comfortable for two men who were batching. Beside the kitchen, there was a living room with a wide double bed built against the wall, properly made up with blue gingham sheets and pillows. There was a little storeroom, too, with a window, where they kept guns and saddles and tools and old coats and boots. That day the floor was covered with garden things, drying for winter. Corn and beans and fat yellow cucumbers. There were no screens or window blinds in the house, and all the doors and windows stood wide open, letting in flies and sunshine alike. Peter put the melons in a row on the oilcloth-covered table and stood over them, brandishing a butcher knife. Before the blade got fairly into them, they split of their own ripeness with a delicious sound. He gave us knives, but no plates, and the top of the table was soon swimming with juice and seeds. I had never seen anyone eat so many melons as Peter ate. He assured us that they were good for one, better than medicine. In his country, people lived on them at this time of year. He was very hospitable and jolly. Once, while he was looking at Antonia, he sighed and told us that if he had stayed at home in Russia, perhaps by this time he would have had a pretty daughter of his own to cook and keep house for him. He said he had left his country because of a great trouble. When we got up to go, Peter looked about in perplexity for something that would entertain us. He ran into the storeroom and brought out a gaudily painted harmonica, sat down on a bench, and spreading his fat legs apart, began to play like a whole band. The tunes were either very lively or very doleful, and he sang words to some of them. Before we left, Peter put ripe cucumbers into a sack for Mrs. Shimerda and gave us a lard pail full of milk to cook them in. I had never heard of cooking cucumbers, but Antonia assured me they were very good. We had to walk the pony all the way home to keep from spilling the milk. Chapter 6. One afternoon we were having our reading lesson on the warm, grassy bank where the badger lived. It was a day of amber sunlight, but there was a shiver of coming winter in the air. I had seen ice on the little horse pond that morning, and as we went through the garden we found the tall asparagus with its red berries lying on the ground, a mass of slimy green. Tony was barefooted, and she shivered in her cotton dress and was comfortable only when we were tucked down on the baked earth in the full blaze of the sun. She could talk to me about almost anything by this time. That afternoon she was telling me how highly esteemed our friend the badger was in her part of the world, and how men kept a special kind of dog with very short legs to hunt him. "Those dogs," she said, "went down into the hole after the badger and killed him there in a terrific struggle underground. You could hear the barks and yelps outside. Then the dog dragged himself back, covered with bites and scratches, to be rewarded and petted by his master." She knew a dog who had a star on his collar for every badger he had killed. The rabbits were unusually spry that afternoon. They kept starting up all about us and dashing off down the draw as if they were playing a game of some kind. But the little buzzing things that lived in the grass were all dead, all but one. While we were lying there against the warm bank, a little insect of the palest, frailest green hopped painfully out of the buffalo grass and tried to leap into a bunch of bluestem. He missed it, fell back, and sat with his head sunk between his long legs, his antennae quivering as if he were waiting for something to come and finish him. Tony made a warm nest for him in her hands, talked to him gaily and indulgently in Bohemian. Presently he began to sing for us, a thin, rusty little chirp. She held him close to her ear and laughed, but a moment afterward I saw there were tears in her eyes. She told me that in her village at home there was an old beggar woman who went about selling herbs and roots she had dug up in the forest. If you took her in and gave her a warm place by the fire, she sang old songs to the children in a cracked voice like this. Old Hatta, she was called, and the children loved to see her coming and save their cakes and sweets for her. When the bank on the other side of the draw began to throw a narrow shelf of shadow, we knew we ought to be starting homeward. The chill came on quickly when the sun got low, and Antonia's dress was thin. What were we to do with the frail little creature we had lured back to life by false pretenses? I offered my pockets, but Tony shook her head and carefully put the green insect in her hair, tying her big handkerchief down loosely over her curls. I said I would go with her until we could see Squaw Creek, and then turn and run home. We drifted along lazily, very happy, through the magical light of the late afternoon. All those fall afternoons were the same, but I never got used to them. As far as we could see, the miles of copper-red grass were drenched in sunlight that was stronger and fiercer than at any other time of the day. The blonde cornfields were red-gold, the haystacks turned rosy and threw long shadows. The whole prairie was like the bush that burned with fire and was not consumed. That hour always had the exultation of victory, of triumphant ending, like a hero's death, heroes who died young and gloriously. It was a sudden transfiguration, a lifting up of day. How many an afternoon Antonia and I have trailed along the prairie under that magnificence! And always two long black shadows flitted before us or followed after, dark spots on the ruddy grass. We had been silent a long time, and the edge of the sun sank nearer and nearer the prairie floor when we saw a figure moving on the edge of the upland, a gun over his shoulder. He was walking slowly, dragging his feet along as if he had no purpose. We broke into a run to overtake him.
"My papa sick all the time," Tony panted as we flew. "He not look good, Jim."
As we neared Mr. Shimerda, she shouted, and he lifted his head and peered about. Tony ran up to him, caught his hand, and pressed it against her cheek. She was the only one of his family who could rouse the old man from the torpor in which he seemed to live. He took the bag from his belt and showed us three rabbits he had shot, looked at Antonia with a wintry flicker of a smile, and began to tell her something. She turned to me.
"My Tatinik make me little hat with the skins, little hat for winter," she exclaimed joyfully. "Meat for eat, skin for hat," she told off these benefits on her fingers.
Her father put his hand on her hair, but she caught his wrist and lifted it carefully away, talking to him rapidly. I heard the name of old Hata. He untied the handkerchief, separated her hair with his fingers, and stood looking down at the green insect. When it began to chirp faintly, he listened as if it were a beautiful sound. I picked up the gun he had dropped, a queer piece from the old country, short and heavy with a stag's head on the cock. When he saw me examining it, he turned to me with his faraway look that always made me feel as if I were down at the bottom of a well. He spoke kindly and gravely, and Antonia translated.
"My Tatinik say when you are big boy, he give you his gun. Very fine, from Bohemi. It was belong to a great man, very rich, like what you not got here. Many fields, many forests, many big house. My papa play for his wedding, and he give my papa fine gun, and my papa give you."
I was glad that this project was one of futurity. There never was such people as the Shimerdas for wanting to give away everything they had. Even the mother was always offering me things, though I knew she expected substantial presents in return. We stood there in friendly silence, while the feeble minstrel sheltered in Antonia's hair went on with its scratchy chirp. The old man's smile, as he listened, was so full of sadness, of pity for things, that I never afterward forgot it. As the sun sank, there came a sudden coolness and the strong smell of earth and drying grass. Antonia and her father went off hand in hand, and I buttoned up my jacket and raced my shadow home. Chapter 7. Much as I liked Antonia, I hated a superior tone that she sometimes took with me. She was 4 years older than I, to be sure, and had seen more of the world, but I was a boy and she was a girl, and I resented her protecting manner. Before the autumn was over, she began to treat me more like an equal and to defer to me in other things than reading lessons. This change came about from an adventure we had together. One day when I rode over to the Shimerdas, I found Antonia starting off on foot for Russian Peter's house to borrow a spade Ambrosch needed. I offered to take her on the pony, and she got up behind me. There had been another black frost the night before, and the air was clear and heady as wine. Within a week all the blooming roads had been despoiled. Hundreds of miles of yellow sunflowers had been transformed into brown, rattling, burry stalks. We found Russian Peter digging his potatoes. We were glad to go in and get warm by his kitchen stove and to see his squashes and Christmas melons heaped in the storeroom for winter. As we rode away with the spade, Antonia suggested that we stop at the prairie dog town and dig into one of the holes. We could find out whether they ran straight down or were horizontal like mole holes, whether they had underground connections, whether the owls had nests down there lined with feathers. We might get some puppies or owl eggs or snake skins. The dog town was spread out over perhaps 10 acres. The grass had been nibbled short and even, so this stretch was not shaggy and red like the surrounding country, but gray and velvety. The holes were several yards apart and were disposed with a good deal of regularity, almost as if the town had been laid out in streets and avenues. One always felt that an orderly and very sociable kind of life was going on there. I picketed Dude down in a draw, and we went wandering about, looking for a hole that would be easy to dig. The dogs were out, as usual, dozens of them, sitting up on their hind legs over the doors of their houses. As we approached, they barked, shook their tails at us, and scurried underground. Before the mouths of the holes were little patches of sand and gravel, scratched up, we supposed, from a long way below the surface. Here and there, in the town, we came on larger gravel patches several yards away from any hole. If the dogs had scratched the sand up in excavating, how had they carried it so far? It was on one of these gravel beds that I met my adventure. We were examining a big hole with two entrances. The burrow sloped into the ground at a gentle angle so that we could see where the two corridors united, and the floor was dusty from use, like a little highway over which much travel went. I was walking backward in a crouching position when I heard Antonia scream. She was standing opposite me, pointing behind me and shouting something in Bohemian. I whirled around, and there, on one of those dry gravel beds, was the biggest snake I had ever seen. He was sunning himself, after the cold night, and he must have been asleep when Antonia screamed. When I turned, he was lying in long, loose waves, like a letter W. He twitched and began to coil slowly. He was not merely a big snake, I thought. He was a circus monstrosity. His abominable muscularity, his loathsome, fluid motion somehow made me sick. He was as thick as my leg, and looked as if millstones couldn't crush the disgusting vitality out of him. He lifted his hideous little head and rattled. I didn't run because I didn't think of it. If my back had been against a stone wall, I couldn't have felt more cornered. I saw his coils tighten. Now he would spring his length, I remembered. I ran up and drove at his head with my spade, struck him fairly across the neck, and in a minute he was all about my feet in wavy loops. I struck now from hate. Antonia, barefooted as she was, ran up behind me. Even after I had pounded his ugly head flat, his body kept on coiling and winding, doubling and falling back on itself. I walked away and turned my back. I felt seasick. Antonia came after me, crying,
"Oh, Jimmy, he not bite you? You sure? Why you not run when I say? Why did you jabber Bohunk for? You might have told me there was a snake behind me," I said petulantly. "I know, I am just awful, Jim. I was so scared."
She took my handkerchief from my pocket and tried to wipe my face with it, but I snatched it away from her. I suppose I looked as sick as I felt.
"I never know you were so brave, Jim," she went on comfortingly. "You is just like big man's. You wait for him lift his head, and then you go for him. Ain't you feel scared a bit? Now we take that snake home and show everybody. Nobody ain't seen in this country so big snake like you kill."
She went on in this strain until I began to think that I had longed for this opportunity and had hailed it with joy. Cautiously, we went back to the snake. He was still groping with his tail, turning up his ugly belly in the light. A faint, fetid smell came from him, and a thread of green liquid oozed from his crushed head.
"Look, Tony, that's his poison," I said.
I took a long piece of string from my pocket, and she lifted his head with the spade while I tied a noose around it. We pulled him out straight and measured him by my riding quirt. He was about 5.5 feet long. He had 12 rattles, but they were broken off before they began to taper, so I insisted that he must once have had 24. I explained to Antonia how this meant that he was 24 years old, that he must have been there when white men first came, left on from buffalo in Indian times. As I turned him over, I began to feel proud of him, to have a kind of respect for his age and size. He seemed like the ancient, eldest evil. Certainly his kind have left horrible unconscious memories in all warm-blooded life. When we dragged him down into the draw, Dude sprang off to the end of his tether and shivered all over, wouldn't let us come near him. We decided that Antonia should ride Dude home, and I would walk. As she rode along slowly, her bare legs swinging against the pony's sides, she kept shouting back to me about how astonished everybody would be. I followed with the spade over my shoulder, dragging my snake. Her exultation was contagious. The great land had never looked to me so big and free. If the red grass were full of rattlers, I was equal to them all. Nevertheless, I stole furtive glances behind me now and then to see that no avenging mate, older and bigger than my quarry, was racing up from the rear. The sun had set when we reached our garden and went down the draw toward the house. Otto Fuchs was the first one we met. He was sitting on the edge of the cattle pond having a quiet pipe before supper. Antonia called him to come quick and look. He did not say anything for a minute, but scratched his head and turned the snake over with his boot.
"Where did you run onto that beauty, Jim?"
"Up at the dog town," I answered laconically.
"Kill him yourself? How come you to have a weepin'?"
"We'd been up to Russian Peter's to borrow a spade for Ambrosch." Otto shook the ashes out of his pipe and squatted down to count the rattles.
"It was just luck you had a tool," he said cautiously. "Gosh, I wouldn't want to do any business with that fellow myself unless I had a fence post along. Your grandmother's snake cane wouldn't more than tickle him. He could stand right up and talk to you, he could. Did he fight hard?"
Antonia broke in.
"He fights something awful. He is all over Jimmy's boots. I screamed for him to run, but he just hit and hit that snake like he was crazy."
Otto winked at me. After Antonia rode on, he said, "Got him in the head first crack, didn't you? That was just as well." We hung him up to the windmill, and when I went down to the kitchen, I found Antonia standing in the middle of the floor telling the story with a great deal of color. Subsequent experiences with rattlesnakes taught me that my first encounter was fortunate in circumstance. My big rattler was old and had led too easy a life. There was not much fight in him. He had probably lived there for years, with a fat prairie dog for breakfast whenever he felt like it, a sheltered home, even an owl feather bed, perhaps, and he had forgot that the world doesn't owe rattlers a living. A snake of his size and fighting trim would be more than any boy could handle. So in reality it was a mock adventure. The game was fixed for me by chance, as it probably was for many a dragon slayer. I had been adequately armed by Russian Peter, the snake was old and lazy, and I had Antonia beside me to appreciate and admire. That snake hung on our corral fence for several days. Some of the neighbors came to see it and agreed that it was the biggest rattler ever killed in those parts. This was enough for Antonia. She liked me better from that time on, and she never took a supercilious air with me again. I had killed a big snake. I was now a big fellow.
Chapter 8. While the autumn color was growing pale on the grass and cornfields, things went badly with our friends the Russians. Peter told his troubles to Mr. Shimerda. He was unable to meet a note which fell due on the 1st of November. Had to pay an